Simpkins and Lawrence Marable on drums. Here on All Night Jazz on Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We are KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg, Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute at 90.3, and you can find us online, listen live there, anytime at kansaspublicradio.org.
The number of people who will develop Alzheimer's disease by the year 2050, you know, do the math, that's 25 short years away, is going to triple from the number of people who live with it today.
That's Lisa Skinner. She's a behavioral expert in the field of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias.
A person can actually minimize their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by making healthier and better lifestyle choices by up to 40%, starting at any age, at any stage of their life.
I'm Dan Skinner. I'll talk with Lisa Skinner about truth, lies, and Alzheimer's, its secret faces. That's ahead on Conversations. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Portland, Oregon Mayor Keith Wilson is responding to President Trump's announcement that he's planning to send troops to the city.
President Trump has directed all necessary troops to Portland, Oregon. The number of necessary troops is zero.
On social media this weekend, Trump said troops were necessary to protect immigration facilities from protesters. His announcement makes Portland the latest Democratic-led city to face a troop deployment. But Mayor Wilson says Portland is not a military target. He spoke at a news conference with Governor Tina Kotek. They say the troops would only inflame tensions. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has confirmed the identities of the three detainees who were shot at its field office in Dallas last Wednesday. Tolomani Osabamowo with member station KERA reports that one victim's family says he's in grave condition in the hospital.
Norlin Guzman Fuentes, a 37-year-old from El Salvador, was killed in the shooting. The Dallas County Medical Examiner's Office lists his cause of death as homicide. Miguel Garcia Hernandez of Mexico remains in the hospital. A third detainee, Jose Bordones Molina of Venezuela, was injured in the shooting, but his condition is unclear. An ICE official confirmed the men's identities, but did not specify when or why they were taken into custody. Authorities say 29-year-old Fairview resident Joshua Yon shot at the ICE office from a nearby building before turning the gun on himself. The Department of Justice says Yon meant to target ICE agents. For NPR News, I'm Toluwani Osibamowo in Dallas.
President Trump is scheduled to meet tomorrow with top congressional Republicans and Democrats, a meeting confirmed last night in a joint statement from House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. The meeting will take place one day before the deadline to fund government operations or face a partial shutdown. International humanitarian aid groups are still reeling from the Trump administration's decision to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports there was a lot of concern about that at the U.N. General Assembly last week.
After one side meeting about the record number of people fleeing conflicts around the world, Jan Egeland, the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, told NPR that aid organizations are still hurting from U.S. budget cuts.
It has consequences to the smallest refugee camp. I've seen water towers not being filled anymore with drinking water to refugee camps because the one group that was responsible for that lost all U.S. funding overnight.
He says other countries have followed the U.S. lead, cutting aid and closing borders, a double blow for the world's refugees. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the United Nations.
And from Washington, you're listening to NPR News. Officials in southern India say a stampede at a political rally killed at least 39 people and injured dozens of others. The rally in the state of Tamil Nadu was for a popular Indian actor turned politician who was speaking when the crowd surged. The government has announced an investigation. Tens of thousands had gathered for the rally amid sweltering heat. Voters in Moldova going to the polls today in a high-stakes parliamentary election that could affect efforts to join the European Union. Russia is accused of mounting a vote-buying and disinformation operation, allegation that Moscow dismisses. In Switzerland, voters are deciding on whether to introduce electronic identity cards. A similar referendum failed in 2021. Retired U.S. Foreign Service officer Tess Johnston died this month in Washington, D.C. Johnston had a second career documenting the colonial architecture of Shanghai, as NPR's Frank Langford reports.
Johnston roamed the streets and back alleys, cataloging French-style villas and neoclassical buildings that gave Shanghai its cosmopolitan face. It was a race against the wrecking ball as China's boom fueled the mass demolition of colonial architecture in favor of modern high-rises. As she told me in 2016.
Where else in the world would you find such a variety of buildings, maybe New York City? And it was just enchanting, really enchanting.
With Chinese photographer Erdong Chang, Johnston published more than two dozen books, introducing a new generation to an architectural heritage that had largely been forgotten. As she put it, I'm grateful I could be here and see it as it was. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
And I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
Good morning, and welcome to Conversations. I'm Dan Skinner. Today, a discussion about Alzheimer's and dementia. Lisa Skinner is a behavioral expert in the field of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. In her over 25-year career as a community counselor, private advisor, and regional director of senior care facilities, she has helped thousands of families find the best care options for their loved ones. Her previous book was the number one selling Not All Who Wonder Need Be Lost. She joins us to talk about Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, its secret faces. Lisa, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it very, very much.
Well, before we talk about the book specifically, I want to draw upon your expertise regarding a question I'm sure a lot of us wonder about, not only for our loved ones, but for ourselves. And that's, when do we become concerned? Because as we get older, we start experiencing some memory lapses. We may not be able to find a word, although it may turn up later. Give us some guidance here. What's normal? And when should we be concerned that there's something else going on?
That is the $64 million question. And I am asked that on a regular basis. And there is a difference between what we call normal aging forgetfulness, and then there's an intermediate stage that we refer to as mild cognitive impairment, and then there's full-blown dementia. So the best way for me to kind of differentiate for the audience when to be concerned is when the memory loss becomes much more severe and much more significant than walking into a room and forgetting why you walked in there. It happens to all of us. That is part of normal aging. Having a conversation with somebody and then all of a sudden the name that you're going to say flies out of your head. That's very normal. Not remembering where you put your phone down or your keys. These are all part of the normal aging forgetfulness process. Not to be worried. Then there's the intermediate stage, which we call mild cognitive impairment, which really is a more severe and more frequent occurrence than what you experience with the normal aging process. But it still is not significantly impacting your activities of daily life. Now, the one thing that a lot of people aren't aware of, and I want to just make sure that this is clear because it's an important point. Mild cognitive impairment sometimes is a precursor to full-blown dementia, but only if the cause, the root cause of the cognitive decline, the symptoms that you're experiencing, are due to a neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's. But it's not the case in every situation. There are medical conditions that people are suffering that a lot of times they don't even know about, like a urinary tract infection, a thyroid condition, depression. There are a host of medical conditions that can mirror the same symptomology that we see with dementia, but it's not caused by one of these brain diseases like Alzheimer's. So they can be managed. They can be cured with antibiotics or whatever treatment, thyroid medication. And a lot of times in those cases, the symptoms are reversible. That's not the case if somebody is developing Alzheimer's disease. So one of the main things to remember is if a person notices that their cognitive hiccups, let's call them, are continuing to happen more frequently and more severely, and maybe get to the point where they are missing appointments or they're having trouble following directions or using simple appliances, those are red flags. One of the biggest red flag is they start asking the same question over and over again in the same conversation or repeating the same story in the same conversation. That's a big one. So when the cognitive decline, the memory lapses, really start interfering with a person's daily life functioning, then that is cause for concern, and you really should then be assessed by a medical professional.
Well, you've written two books now regarding Alzheimer's and dementia, and we're not going to have time to go through everything that's in this book. So could you give us a brief overview of what people are going to find here? Then we'll dig into a few specifics.
So one of the probably most profound observations that I've made in the 30 years that I have been helping families through this difficult journey is that there seems to be a clear lack of understanding of exactly what these brain diseases, and there are about 200 known brain diseases that cause similar symptoms that we put into this bucket that we call dementia. And they differ from person to person. But the one common denominator that I have realized is people aren't clear on exactly what these diseases are doing to our brains and the symptoms that are a result of the changing brain, the damage being done to the brain, is much more severe and much more complicated than just memory loss and confusion. And that's really what most people associate dementia with, like Alzheimer's disease. And that's not the case. The crux of the situation is that we eventually lose pretty much all of our cognitive function ability. So we lose our ability to reason. We lose our ability to use judgment about things. Our personalities change. We start relying on raw emotion to react to any given situation that pretty much happens in our environments. And these are all things that people don't necessarily look for. So they don't expect these behavioral expressions or these behavioral changes because they're not necessarily associating these other symptoms with being part of the disease. So I wrote the book as a resource, as a means to help people understand what it is truly like to live with Alzheimer's disease or Lewy body disease or frontotemporal dementia, on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis. And that's the place that everybody, if you happen to receive a dementia diagnosis, then that's the place to start. And that was really the sole purpose of the book, is to give people, raise awareness and to give people a better understanding of what to expect so they can be more prepared. And what I have observed is once you get that diagnosis, people are in a constant state of being reactive because they don't know what to expect. They don't understand the disease. So by understanding, that's going to put people in a better situation to be more prepared and proactively go through this journey with the person they're caring for or with their family member than what I've seen, because they don't clearly understand what the symptomology actually involves with these brain diseases.
Your book is described as an unconventional approach. And is that part of it? You think that people conventionally just are reactive and you are encouraging people to be proactive regarding these conditions?
That's exactly right, Dan. And the reason why I did make that statement, because the best practices, the most effective responses to a lot of the things that we see as the brain is changing is counterintuitive to the way that we instinctively want to respond to some of the behaviors we see. So let me give you a couple of quick examples. One of the things that's really common in people living with these brain diseases is they have delusions or false beliefs. So it's not uncommon for somebody with dementia to believe that their late spouse is still alive and well and maybe waiting for them at home. The way we're all wired, our instinctive reaction would be what? To correct them, to try to steer them back into our reality. But the honest truth is, they believe that person is still alive, and that is their reality. It's just not aligned with our reality, and it doesn't work. We tried that approach for decades called reality orientation therapy. It doesn't work. It only creates more anxiety, more frustration for the person living with the dementia, and can actually exacerbate the situation and send them into what we call a catastrophic reaction or a total meltdown. It's synonymous with having a meltdown. So the new approach is, and I refer to this in my book, a person-centered approach to dementia care. And part of that methodology is to do what we call join their reality, meet them where they're at, because we found out through reality orientation therapy that did not work, that there's nothing any of us can say or do to convince somebody who's having a false belief that it's not their truth. So we have to meet them where they're at and join their belief and their truth until their short-term memory comes back to being aligned with our reality. And that's what we've discovered, and that's the state-of-the-art, the popular methodology of teaching. So that's what I meant by unconventional approach, because it is counterintuitive. We are not instinctively wired to go along with somebody's belief if it's not aligned with ours. It's just part of our human nature. So we literally have to retrain our brains and learn to communicate a little differently when we're dealing with brain diseases.
So one of the things I'm sure people are wondering about is, because there's so much we still don't know about many of these brain diseases, is there anything we can do to try to prevent those? You know, does it have to do with nutrition? Does it have to do with mental activity? You know, what can we do?
There are a host of risk factors that play into either increasing a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or one of the other brain diseases, or conversely, minimizing that risk. There are several of these risk factors that we call non-modifiable. It's age, genetics, ethnicity, and gender. And we can't change any of those risk factors. So if every single one of those risk factors that puts you in the higher risk category applies to, you know, you as an individual, or risk factors kind of working against you, then there are the another set of risk factors that we refer to as modifiable. And the number one risk factor that can be managed or treated that we put into this category of modifiable risk factors is cardiovascular disease. So if you suffer from hypertension or high blood pressure, if you have a heart condition, that's the number one risk factor that increases a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. There's lifestyle choices, exercising, cognitive stimulation, diet. Then there's other underlying diseases that play a role into either increasing your risk or minimizing your risk. And that's if you have like sleep apnea or diabetes. There's a huge list. But the point being is the more of these risk factors that apply to any one individual increases their risk. But to kind of piggyback on your question, there is no known prevention. These diseases does not discriminate against anybody. It can strike anybody at any time. However, we do know now through scientific research and studies, decades-long studies, that a person can actually minimize their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease by making healthier and better lifestyle choices by up to 40%, starting at any age, at any stage of their life. So that would be developing a routine exercise program, following a healthier diet lifestyle. So eliminating simple carbohydrates and ultra processed foods is the worst, which a lot of fast foods fall into that category. Eating more lean meats versus red meats, leafy green vegetables, fruits, also adopting a regimen of cognitive stimulation exercises are the number one best thing that we know we can do, especially as we get older, to stimulate our brains, is to learn a foreign language or a musical instrument, because the parts of our brains that we use to achieve those activities really makes us work. It's critical thinking skills. So these are some of the things that we know can minimize our risk. Does it work all the time? No. But it's significant enough. We know it's significant enough that it's worth implementing lifestyle, healthy lifestyle decisions and practices that, you know, by the time you're 85, if you're not one in the three people today who will develop Alzheimer's disease at, by the age of 85, then you might be able to attribute it to adapting these lifestyle changes and managing the medical conditions that you have. Hearing loss is a huge risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease, but it's manageable. How? We wear hearing aids. If you have sleep apnea, use a CPAP machine. These things can make a critical difference in minimizing a person's risk.
One of the things I take from your book and our discussion is that the more information we have, the better it helps us be prepared and help us to be proactive. But part of the problem is, for a lot of people, there are many myths out there about Alzheimer's that are going to get in the way of making informed and correct decisions. So tell us a little bit about some of the common myths about Alzheimer's and dementia.
Oh, there's so many out there, Dan, and it's very frustrating because they do influence how people think about these diseases. One of them, which is very common and popular, is that this is only an older person's disease. That's absolutely not true. We are seeing a higher instance of what we call early onset dementia, which actually the symptomology appears before the age of 65 versus traditional Alzheimer's disease, which typically starts showing up beginning at the age of 65. And then for every 5 years that we age past the age of 65, our risk almost doubles. So when you're 70, when you're 75, when you're 80, and then by the time we're 85, one in three of us will have it. But early onset, which is a rarer form of Alzheimer's disease, is showing up in younger and younger people. As a matter of fact, for the longest time, I think I had read through my research that the youngest was about 30 years old. More recently, the youngest now was diagnosed at 19 years old. And we're not really sure why we're seeing this trend. Could be environmental factors. Nobody knows. To date, to be honest with you, we still don't even know what causes Alzheimer's disease.
What would you say are some of the key concepts that you hope readers are going to take away after reading your book?
I just want to preface answering that question by saying we truly are, as a society, a global society, in the midst of a health crisis. And the reason why I make that strong statement is because the World Health Organization and the various Alzheimer's associations from all over the world are preparing us that if a cure or a treatment is not found, and right now we have nothing on the horizon, that the number of people who will develop Alzheimer's disease by the year 2050, you know, do the math, that's 25 short years away, is going to triple from the number of people who live with it today. Currently, it's the sixth leading cause of death in the elderly population in the U.S., but in the U.K., in Finland, and in the Netherlands, it's the number one cause of death in our elderly population. So I call it the tsunami that's on its way. So to answer your question, because it's directly related to what I just said, we're not prepared for the number of people who are projected to develop Alzheimer's disease or one of the other brain diseases in the next 25 years. How can we be more prepared? Through knowledge, through education, through learning specialized skills on how to communicate effectively with people who can no longer or eventually will no longer be able to communicate with us in the way that they do when their brains are healthy. And these are all critical components to trying to solve a problem that is clearly on its way. And this is what it's going to take. So I've dedicated my career to raising this awareness because it probably, I've had eight of my own family members. I don't know if you read that in the book. But besides choosing this as my professional career, I actually have had eight of my own family members live with one of the diseases that causes dementia. And I have to honestly say, plus the families that I've guided through this journey, it's probably one of the most difficult undertakings that any of us will ever experience because of all the cognitive function that is lost in the process of this disease. It completely changes the playing field for all of us trying to care for somebody that as they progress through the disease, they eventually will be completely 100% dependent on somebody else caring for them and helping them with all of their activities of daily living.
To learn more, the book is Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces by Lisa Skinner and Douglas Collins. Lisa, thank you for talking with me today.
Thanks again for having me and for supporting this very, very important topic.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 58 and fair. Wind is from the north. Today, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid 80s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. It's 58 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
Say you're an artist and you want to paint something you can't see, but your AI collaborator can.
I built a multi-robotic system connected to the flow of New York City. By the end of it, myself and the robots were covered in paint. Probably the strangest landscape painting you've ever seen.
Creating and dreaming with AI. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge.
To the Best of Our Knowledge is Sunday morning at 11 on KPR.
It's football season, baby, and that means big upsets, impossible comebacks, nail-biting finishes, plus sports betting ads. Lots and lots of sports betting ads.
Football is back, and DraftKings has an incredible offer.
New customers turn $5 into $200 instantly in bonus bets.
We're giving away over $1 million in prizes with FanDuel free-to-play games.
BetMGM. Download and bet today.
DraftKings Sportsbook.
FanDuel. Official partner of the NFL.
But sports betting isn't just affecting our ad intake. It's changing the way we watch games.
The game gets out of hand early, and all of a sudden, it looks like there's no chance of the other team coming back. Most of non-betting audience will not tune in for the second half, and you mainly just have the announcers trying to desperately keep the audience engaged by telling these stories. But the betting audience is still watching because they still have interest in the outcomes of the game.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Matt Dara. Today on the show, the new era of sports betting. This whole sports betting phenomenon is a fairly new thing. It was federally banned until 2018. Now 35 states have legal sports betting in some form, and around 75 million people bet on sports last year. That's 20% of the U.S. population. Brendan Dwyer is a sport leadership professor and the director of research in distance learning at the Center for Sport Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. He studies how sports betting has shifted what it means to be an engaged fan. Brendan, for much of my life, sports betting in the U.S. has been illegal, but things changed in 2018. What happened?
Yes, in 2018, the federal law of PASPA was deregulated so that it was up to the states to determine if they wanted gambling to be legalized. And really, it being struck down was a big move because at that point we only had legalized sports betting in Nevada and a few other states in some form. So since then, we've had 34, 35 now with Missouri states legalizing it. And leaving it up to the states has really provided an opportunity for them to find additional ways of revenue.
Why did it take so long for sports betting to become legalized? What was the hangup?
Oh, I mean, it's really the social ill argument. It's, you know, the same reason that it's hard for casinos to get passed in certain jurisdictions. You know, sports betting has been seen by society as something that can only be done in a casino. You can get addicted to sports betting. If you get addicted to sports betting, there's the downside of it. And so, you know, the federal law or the state should be protecting its consumers from the perils of sports betting.
Weren't big sports leagues like the NFL against sports betting for the longest time as well?
Yes, that's the other major aspect of it, is the integrity of the game. There was the 1919 Black Sox with the Chicago White Sox, and then there's the Pete Rose incident.
One of the game's greatest players has engaged in a variety of acts which have stained the game, and he must now live with the consequences of those acts. This sorry episode began last February when baseball received firm allegations that Mr. Rose bet on baseball games and on the Reds games. Such grave charges could not and must never be ignored. Mr. Rose has accepted baseball's ultimate sanction, which is lifetime ineligibility.
Yes, the leagues for the longest times also did not want sports betting for that reason. They're worried about their players potentially betting, referees, which we had an issue with that in 2006, 2007 with a referee betting, and then the trickle-down effect to college athletics and how that could be impacted with the student athletes.
Right. Well, what are the biggest sports betting companies in the U.S.?
Yeah, so FanDuel and DraftKings own about 35% of the market each. So those two are the biggest two. And a lot of that has to stem from they were the first two to enter in daily fantasy sports. So DraftKings and FanDuel are the two biggest. And then we have BetMGM, which is also a big player. But then there's a number of other small ones associated with, you know, like you see Fox is getting involved. ESPN is trying to get involved. Hmm. You have William Hill. Caesars would be equivalent to BetMGM, but there's a number of smaller groups that are really trying to enter the market, and that's one of the challenges for any of the sports books and any of those companies is it's a very flooded marketplace.
And of course, if you're a sports fan and, you know, don't live under a rock, you've probably been inundated with ads from these sports books over the last couple of years. They've got to be spending just astronomical money on these things. Is it unprecedented in the sports industry?
Yeah, I mean, we went through it, you know, with the crypto boom too, right? Like, I think the amount of revenue funneling into the sports industry from advertisement from the sports books is unprecedented, right? They are trying to attract consumers, get loyal customers to their app or to their sports book. And to do so, they have these incentives. They are trying to get people not only to bet the day of, during games. And yes, that money flows through advertisements to the media providers, the broadcasters, and then eventually to the teams and to the players. So it's been a huge benefit to the teams and the leagues. And this is one of the, you know, Mark Cuban did an interview, I think, in 2020 or 2021, where he said, I think sports betting is going to double the value of my franchise. He owns the Dallas Mavericks. And a lot of that has to do with the revenue that is coming from the sports books itself.
That's wild. For those who aren't big into sports, what are these ads like? How are they trying to appeal to fans?
So I think what they're trying to do is, first of all, they're trying to incentivize to use the app, but they're really also aspirational and trying to show a lifestyle, a successful lifestyle of sports betting. So they have a lot of celebrities, or they have other comedians. They have the Manning family in certain situations, but they are trying to blend comedy and lifestyle to make it look like sports betting is fun, it's cool, you know, if you're successful, you'll be profitable. They're trying to establish a lifestyle, especially targeting younger men.
Let's actually play one of those ads. This one's from FanDuel for the National Football League.
Garbage time. That phrase never sounded quite right, because no part of football is meaningless. So while some folks see garbage, FanDuel sees treasure. We see spreads to cover, overs to hit, and chances to live bet from the first down to the final whistle. So don't just watch football this season, cherish it.
Bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
Yeah, I mean, every time you go into a game, you see a certain, I think I have this edge, I think I'm smarter than the sports book, and they set a line here. I think it's going to be this. I think I know what's going to happen, and that's what makes it so exciting. And that gives you a little bit more action on whatever game you're going to play. And so they're trying to entice that feeling so that you want to bet.
Right, and it's almost like they're saying, at least in this commercial, that, you know, you're a better, more engaged fan when you bet, you know?
Yeah, and one of the challenges of being a fan is how you can be a better fan and a bigger fan. You know, some of the benefits of sports betting is the social component and talking to others about what you have bet. Now, oftentimes people only share when they've won. They don't always share the bad side when they lost. Actually, it's this colleague of mine in the hallway. We were talking about this weekend and how he was betting the Ohio State and Texas game. And he, but he was talking about, you know, his behavior during that game. So some people are fine sharing their losses, but oftentimes people just talk about when they won.
How widespread is sports betting these days? Do we know how many people are gambling on games?
You know, it's tough to truly understand, but they're saying around 75 million people are betting on sports these days. It's somewhat, I mean, it ranges depending on your source, but, you know, some say 55 million, some say 75 million. I know the American Gaming Association, their report comes out roughly this time each year, and that's their recent estimate.
75 million. I mean, that seems like a huge number. Why do you think sports betting has taken off so much?
I think television and live television would not be where it is if it wasn't for broadcast sport. And what's driving that these days, more than anything, is not just what's happening on the field, but what's happening off the field. And that comes in the form of fantasy sports and live betting. And people just aren't content with just sitting back and watching a game. They actually want additional action. They want to feel even more engaged. And that's what sports betting does.
You know, and it's not like the sports betting ends when the game starts. You can do live sports bets while the game is still happening, right?
Absolutely. The odds are always changing. I share this story all the time with my students. It's the first time I really witnessed live sports betting in Virginia was during the 2022 World Cup. I think they were watching the Morocco versus Belgium game in Qatar. So it wasn't like it was a game that they were very, very into. But one student had a bet on the total number of corner kicks that were going to be in the game. So a very unique prop bet.
Yeah.
Very unique prop bet. And they were very tied. Both of them were very tied to see how many corner kicks. So each corner kick, they were more and more interested. And it was getting more intense just listening to them get excited. And finally, about midway through the second half, they hit the over. They were very excited. So I thought, you know, that was the end of it. They would be celebrating. They won the bet. And then quickly, right after they won that bet, he quickly turned to his next bet, the in-game betting. He went and saw the odds. He saw that here's an opportunity to pick that. I think Belgium's going to score next. So I just saw, like, wow, you didn't even really celebrate that he just won one bet. He just quickly went to the next bet. So, yes, odds are always changing. Depending on if a player gets hurt, if how the weather, all these different things, the factors change so that you can always be making in-game bets.
You know, you study how this new age of sports betting has changed the way we watch sports. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that has primarily been my line of research. I got into studying this because I first studied fantasy sports participants. I was always fascinated how people who played fantasy sports completely altered and changed the way they viewed professional sports. Well, when sports betting came along in 2018, I was even more fascinated to see how it changed their interactions with professional sports and college sports in the United States. Like, I was seeing and witnessing it impact which games they're watching, how they're watching. I mean, I'll go ahead and use this past weekend when there is a marquee matchup in college football and it's two top-ranked teams playing against each other. You know, the research suggests, regardless if you have any interest in these teams, you're going to bet on that game. And that's just because the amount of coverage that game gets all week. It starts on Monday and it builds all the way through the week. That in college football and the NFL is the exact same way. All of the island games in the NFL, Thursday night, Sunday night and Monday night. All of those games are heavily bet because it's the only games on. The same thing for the high-profile games in the NFL. The Hawaii game, if Hawaii is playing. So if Hawaii is playing, game is heavily bet because bettors that have lost during the day on Saturday, generally bet the Hawaii game as a way to make up losses.
Oh, that's fascinating, because they're at like a terrible time zone. They're like the last game played in the weekend.
But, I mean, to be fair, there are games being played everywhere in all different sports. I mean, one of these things about these apps is it's not just limited to American sports. I remember during the pandemic, during COVID, when nothing was open, and the one thing that was being played and being bet was Russian table tennis. During COVID, there was Russian table tennis going on 24/7, and I think that was primarily just for the betting markets.
Oh, that's funny.
So yes, there's definitely watching more games, but there's also watching games longer. So, you know, let's say it is an island game, so it is a Thursday night game, the game gets out of hand early, and all of a sudden, by the halftime, it's 24-0 or 31-7. And it looks like there's no chance of the other team coming back. Most of non-betting audience will not tune in for the second half. And you mainly just have the announcers trying to desperately keep the audience engaged by telling these stories.
Right.
But the betting audience and the fantasy sports audience is still watching because they still have interest in the outcomes of the game. And so that's really important for advertisers and sponsors to know that they're still going to have an audience. So let's say an advertiser has paid for the 2-minute warning advertisement. It's important to know that they're going to have sports bettors watching that 2-minute warning regardless of an outcome.
You know, I've never bet on sports. I like to think of myself as a, you know, sports purist. I have my teams that I root for, and, you know, I don't watch many games outside of my favorite teams, but, you know, it totally makes sense that people who are betting on sports are watching more games. I would too, you know, if I had money invested.
Yeah, and you're not alone in the sports purist, and this has been... the thing is if you think about how many different sports networks we have and how many different games, it started with college football. They would only have games on Saturdays, and all of a sudden they had games on Thursdays. And now we have games on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays. For the longest time, they would never have games on Fridays because they didn't want to interfere with high school football. And now we have games on Fridays. You know, and the NFL has games on Thursdays, and they'll have games on Saturdays and Sundays and Mondays. All these opportunities to watch and interact with the game. Baseball has altered when their games start. All their games used to start exactly at 7 o'clock or right around there on the East Coast. And now some start at 6, some start at 7:35. If you bet and you are a casual bettor, you watch. If you are someone that's beyond a casual bettor, like someone who is, you know, more advanced bettor, or probably someone that bets too much, you don't really have an interest in watching. You just are betting solely to make money. But for a casual bettor, which is the majority of the betting market, they bet because they want to watch, or they're watching already and want to bet.
I'm curious, you know, has sports betting made fans angrier? Like, you know, if we have actual money riding on a player scoring a certain amount of touchdowns, wouldn't we be more apt to, you know, take it out on said player if he underdelivers?
I have not studied this per se. I have done this in fantasy football. I've not studied it yet in sports betting. I have a hypothesis. I know in fantasy football, because of the headlines associated with this, there's a lot of social media presence of people reaching out to players, reaching out to family members of players, people in the stadiums making comments to players. You have people, you know, somehow getting the phone number of student athletes and texting. So there are these really high profile media stories of bad actors. In fantasy football, the research we have found is people that play fantasy football, even the most avid competitive, are actually more drawn and have a stronger relationship with their fantasy players, the players on their team, than other players. And regardless of the outcome, like, they become closer to these players because they've had them or managed them on their team all year. And as it relates to sports betting, I do believe there are a vocal minority, a very vocal minority, that get upset when their bets don't work out. I think they have a platform through social media. They have cell phones that can get access to people. They can be in the stadium. I believe, I know it's a hypothesis right now, I have no research to back it up yet, that that is still a minority. The majority of sports bettors understand the ups and downs of sports. You know, there are bad breaks that things happen. It's just that they are a silent majority, where that the vocal minority, unfortunately, is very vocal, and they do some horrible, horrible things.
You know, you interviewed people about their sports betting habits, asking them whether they were up or down by the end of the month. What did they say?
Yeah, this is one of the more, and this is something that we're continuing to do research on as I'm starting a new research study. This is one of the more fascinating results. Yes, we ask a question on almost every study that we've done about, at the end of the month, based on how much you've bet, are you positive, are you negative, and what's the total? And over 90% of our respondents thus far say that they are in the positive, so in the black. They are up.
That's
and
hilarious.
It's not a lot. It's not like they're saying they're winning hundreds of dollars. But the majority say they're up $100 or they're up, you know, $50 or $25. But that obviously can't be the truth, right? Because the sports books would not be generating the revenue they are if every single sports bet or 90% of sports bettors were actually in the black at the end of the month.
That's interesting. What do you chalk that up to? You know, are they lying to feel better about themselves? Or, you know, is sports betting so complicated that they don't know if they're actually up or down by the end of the month?
I don't think the app, if you've not been in the apps before, I don't think they do a very good job of showing how you have done in your recent past. So it's not like unless you go search for it, you can see your past transactions. So unless you're searching for it, you can't see, oh, wow, I'm down $135 in the last 2 weeks. So unless you don't search for it, you're not going to know how much money you lost. You just think, oh, I put in this, I put in that. Oh, but I remember winning this one time. So you don't think about the costs that went into it. You just remember the positives, which, you know, it's been established in other forms of research. We remember the good things. We don't always remember the bad things. So I do think it's a little bit of, if you don't have the data in front of you, especially over the course of the month, you don't really know what your results are. So our study that we're starting here now for this current NFL season is to track one group of sports bettors across the entire season and ask them weekly as opposed to over the month.
Yeah, yeah.
To track exactly the ups and downs to see if we can get a better, more accurate response to that question, because something is going on there.
Well, you can't really talk about sports betting without bringing up problem gambling. Who is the most vulnerable population when it comes to sports betting?
That's a good question. In the U.S. right now, there's really three demographics that are most at risk, and that is college student athletes, and I shouldn't say they're at risk of problem betting, but they're at risk because they're most vulnerable to be reached by sports bettors without having really the financial backing that a professional sports athlete. You know, a professional athlete gets millions and millions of dollars, where a college student athlete, the recent legal challenges have made it easier for them to make money. They can still be reached by sports bettors to, you know, miss a free throw or miss a kick, where, you know, that would be an opportunity for them to make additional money. So because they're on a college campus and so many college students bet, it just provides an opportunity for them to be more vulnerable. Another group is income-constrained households. So those are potentially groups that do view this as an investment or do view this as a way out of poverty. So it is income-constrained households. And the last one, and this is the one that I probably study the most because it most aligns with my students, and that is males 18 to 24.
Why 18 to 24?
I think males 18 to 24 probably have the most trouble regulating most of their decisions, but especially as it relates to sports, males 18 to 24 that are sports fans are very confident. They're confident in their abilities of a lot of things, but especially as it relates to sports. They feel like they know more than most people. Also, the advertisements, the way that they are framed, really position the activity to be, like I mentioned before, is almost an aspirational activity to say, wow, this can be my lifestyle. This could be me. And they're targeting that demographic more than others. So they also don't have a ton of discretionary income, because a lot of that 18 to 24 year old, whether they're in entry level positions or they're still in college, it's not like they have a ton of disposable income to be betting on sports. So oftentimes they are relying on credit to potentially bet, which gets them in more trouble.
Sports betting's been legal in most places in the U.S. for close to 10 years now. Do you think it's mostly been a good thing or a bad thing? Like, has it enhanced the sports watching experience, or has it somehow made it worse?
I think for general sports fans, it's made it better. I think we're a little too greedy right now. The industry is a little bit too greedy in the amount of revenue that's coming in. I think we are become too reliant on the advertising revenue, the sponsorship revenue, and we should need to cut back on that because of the at-risk populations. There has not been enough research on the impact of sports betting, especially on these vulnerable demographics, over time. It's not been long enough, and there has not been enough research to support the potential problem gambling, the secondary behaviors associated with loss of money, loss of betting, you know, the alcoholism, the depression that go along with financial loss, to really support the fact that, you know, in other countries that have sports betting, they've had it for much longer, like United Kingdom and Australia, that they regulate how much advertising. You can't advertise 2 hours before an event. You can't advertise on social media during an event. There are certain ways they try to protect consumers from betting too much. We haven't done that yet. We're still advertising, I think, a little bit too much, which I think gets to that. I think we're being a little too greedy. But I think for the general sports fan, it's been a positive experience as long as they regulate their betting behavior.
Do you do any of the sports betting stuff?
Yeah, I do from time to time. I do it when, as I mentioned before, the island game. So like if it's a Thursday night game or it's a Monday night game, I'll do it if it's a game that I plan on watching the whole thing. So I'm usually an individual who goes to bed pretty early, but if it's a game that I have a rooting interest in and I plan to stay up to watch all the way till 11 o'clock on the East Coast, I'll put it's usually $10 or $20 to make a couple hundred. So it's a very risky bet. I know that the chances of me making it, winning the bet, is probably less than 5%, probably even less than 3%. But it's exciting. And I like to know that because I played football, I coached football, I have a PhD that I think I know a little bit more. But the truth is, I think I've only won in the, you know.
Dedicated to helping customers turn boxes with family videos and photos into memories that can be shared with generations to come. More at legacybox.com. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Clear skies, becoming sunny today, highs in the upper 80s. Sunny for tomorrow, highs in the lower 80s. It's 59 degrees in Lawrence, 58 in Topeka. This is KPR.
Thought maybe it's not possible, and I just put it on the shelf.
But not for long. Hawk was soon back at it.
I would go all in on it, try it for a few weeks, every session, and it beats you up. I mean, the crashes on it are pretty traumatic, so you can only try it for so long before you just kind of give up with your body.
Until the X Games Best Trick Contest of 1999.
The announcer actually kind of planted the seed, and he said, "Hey, what about that 900 you've been trying for so long?" And I just thought, why would you put me on the spot here? But I tried one mostly to appease him and the crowd. And then I tried it again, and those two attempts were actually the best that I had ever done at that point. And something clicked.
Are you kidding me?
says he didn't expect it to be such a big deal.
And then the next day, I heard it was live on ESPN, and I started getting stopped on the street and in airports. And people would just point at me and say 900, and I was like, this is surreal. Like, I just didn't never imagine that skateboarding would ever be recognized like this.
Skateboarding has come a long way since then. In 2021, Gui Curry from Brazil landed a 1080. He was just 12 years old. Hawk was there to watch it.
You landed a 1080 for a Tony Hawk. Yep.
Hawk says he's proud of the legacy of that first 900.
I love it. That's why I chose skateboarding. That's why that I've never quit. I just love that it continues to progress. You know, I'm past the years of trying to push those limits, but the fact that I still get to be here and see it and participate in it is a dream come true.
Hawk may not be trying new tricks, but he still skates. He threw down another 900 a few years ago at the age of 48. And last week, he got to bring down the gavel when his board, known as the Birdhouse Falcon 2, was sold to an anonymous buyer. Some of the proceeds will go to his nonprofit, the Skate Park Project. That was legendary skateboarder Tony Hawk.
A 900, that it just boggles the mind. Good morning, I'm Kay McIntyre. I'm here with Laura and Feli and Max on a Sunday morning and trying to imagine what I'm in my mind trying to imagine what that feels like to do a 900 degree angle. Wow.
900. I get motion sick really easy. Yeah. So this is clearly not the sport for me.
Yeah, nor me.
Laura. I can't even get on a merry-go-round at this point.
But that's like Simone Biles mid-air territory, just like spinning. I don't know how anybody does that, but that's why I went into radio and not professional skateboarding or gymnastics. Thank you very much.
900 is not.
I'm glad you did.
900 is not the number for us this morning. 888-577-5268 is the number to make your pledge during our fall fanfare or pledge at kansaspublicradio.org.
That's right. That's the E. Take that next step, particularly if you've never done it before. If not you, who? If not now, when? We need your support. We think we put out a good product. We think you've come to rely on us because we try to do the best we can. Make your pledge now at kansaspublicradio.org or online at kansaspublicradio.org or phone us at 888-577-5268. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Feli. Thank you, Max. And thank you for everyone that has made a pledge this morning for Weekend Edition Sunday from the University of Kansas. We are KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. We've got another hour of Weekend Edition Sunday coming up. The latest news from NPR just about 2 minutes away, followed by news from the KPR newsroom. Stay with us.
Support for KPR comes from Pines Garden and Market, promoting the 2025 Caw Valley Field Day, a celebration of soil, farmers, food, and community, October 11th at the Shirk Farm in North Lawrence. Details at CawValleyFieldDay.com.
Sunny skies today. We're looking for highs in the upper 80s. Light winds from the south, only around 5 miles per hour. Mostly clear overnight tonight, lows in the lower 60s. And for tomorrow, sunny, a little bit cooler with highs in the lower 80s. It's 58 degrees in Atchison, 60 degrees in Emporia, 57 in Manhattan. This is KPR.
City Council meeting last night. Heavy rain on Friday sent floodwaters into town, and another storm moved in yesterday, forcing authorities to temporarily halt a search for people possibly missing. The flooding forced people to seek the safety of rooftops, and the high water washed out a propane distributorship, scattering scores of tanks around town. The flooding in Arizona killed at least 4 people. This is NPR News.
From the KPR Newsroom, I'm Kay McIntyre. Good morning. A portion of Interstate 35 near Emporia was closed temporarily yesterday after a semi-truck caught fire. KAKE reports that firefighters were called to the scene yesterday afternoon and found a Kenworth semi-trailer fully engulfed in flames. The driver, 44-year-old Ricardo Amaya from Arizona, was not injured. Traffic was directed off the highway to allow emergency crews to put it out. The Lane County Sheriff's Office said on social media that crews will return to the area around 1 o'clock this afternoon to finish removing debris and that traffic will be down to one lane. Documents about aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart may soon be declassified almost 90 years after her disappearance. The Associated Press reports that President Trump said via social media that he's directing his administration to release all government records related to Earhart. Many experts are skeptical that there is much more relevant information about Earhart's disappearance, citing earlier document releases by the Federal Bureau of Information and the National Archives. Reuters reports the move comes as President Trump is facing continued pressure to release other government documents, those related to financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Earhart's airplane was last seen on July 2, 1937, as she and crew member Fred Noonan were flying around the world. In college football, KU lost to Cincinnati 37-34. K-State won 34-20.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
Sunny skies today with highs in the upper 80s, light winds from the south. Mostly clear overnight tonight, lows around 61 degrees. And for tomorrow, sunny with highs in the lower 80s. It's 60 degrees in Lawrence. From the KPR Newsroom, I'm Kay McIntyre.
A grave, a tombstone, it's something of comfort. It's a final thing in a good way. So between the very fun, goth kind of thing, there's also a deep reason for all this. And that's why I decided this could be a book.
In the book, you talk about the burial of your friend's mother, who was disappeared during Argentina's dictatorship. This is a deep philosophical question, but why do you think it matters that we find the body after all that time, that we have the burial? Why does that matter to us so much?
Because grieving is important. People don't go through that process. It's absolutely cruel. We don't know what happens after death. And the only comfort we have is the comfort of grieving, of paying respects, of having a place to go and remember. Memory, it's a right.
You visit a lot of cemeteries with all of this history, with colonial settlers, with the marginalized, the disappeared. They're all buried, maybe not side by side. How do you see like those distinctions in life, classism and all of this stuff play out in cemeteries? And is there maybe one cemetery where you felt the contrast most striking?
Well, in every cemetery, you have like the rich at the beginning, or most of the time, the rich at the beginning with the marble, etc., the middle class, and then the people on the ground. But sometimes it's in different cemeteries, and New Orleans, for example. And then there's, for example, what happens a lot in post-colonial societies like Argentina or Australia. An island in Argentina is called Island Martin Garcia, and an island in Australia is called Rodney's Island. White settlers that have their cemetery with their colonial family saying they came from this and this place in Europe. And then you have a mostly unmarked, in the case of Australia, for the Aboriginals and from the indigenous people in Argentina. So yes, you can see it sometimes in the same cemetery, sometimes in two cemeteries in the same town, but it's the same as life. That's what's very striking.
When you're going to these cemeteries, do you often meet people who are also have the same interest as you in cemeteries? Do you meet fellow travelers?
I do sometimes. Rarely. What you meet a lot is what I call peregrines. People that go this to see a special grave, and you are going to visit the same person. And sometimes you recognize each other, like we see each other. Yeah, there's a very strange kind. I guess I'm one of those strange people, too. But to me, the others look strange.
Well, you went to the Paris catacombs to see what remains of the Holy Innocent Cemetery, but you take a souvenir.
Well, that's illegal.
Well, it's in the book, though.
I know, but you know, when things are in books, you can always say, well, it's a bit of fiction. I can say that, but this is a non-fiction book, so, you know, whatever. But I went to the catacombs, and I'm fascinated by this cemetery because it's featured in many, many books I love. And I said, okay, I'm going to take a little bone with me. I mean, I fully respect the people in the catacombs in Paris and stuff, but the security is not great.
Clearly.
Clearly, because it was not difficult to do that.
You may not want to say if you still have it, because the authorities may be listening. But what do you think of something like that and the respect for the dead? Do you take that seriously?
Yes, of course I think that the dead may be. It was a moment of insanity.
Okay, yes.
It's very wrong. But since I've been very respectful with it, but I also think, taking it more lightly, that sometimes I think when I'm doing these investigations and, you know, walking there and taking my notes and seeing what's written on the graves and the fact that the dead are so lonely, sometimes I think that yes, that you can be a bit less solemn and respectful and go there and have a Coke and have a chat. There were people, they are people, and I think they would like a friend. It sounds weird, but it's not. I wouldn't like to be there lonely forever.
Because you could have some joy. Yeah, you could have some joy around you. Do you know where you want to be buried? I think you talk about this in the book. And how did you decide?
The cemetery of Recoleta in Buenos Aires, where Eva Perón is buried, among other people, but the most famous is Eva Perón, Evita. It's a very aristocratic cemetery, therefore you only can be buried there if you are a member of one of those aristocratic families, which I'm not. Since I'm not an aristocratic person, I have to occupy that. And the only way to occupy that cemetery is, you know, to have someone put my ashes there. And I want them to be thrown in a grave that it's a pyramid that says there's nothing here, only dust and bones, nothing.
That's Mariana Enriquez. Her new book, Somebody is Walking on Your Grave, comes out on Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you. It was great.
From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. Good morning, I'm Kay McIntyre here for Weekend Edition Sunday. And you may not know this about me, but I am a kind of morbid person. I love a good cemetery. I'm here with Laura Larson and Felonies Lovato Winston. Laura, I think you maybe do know this about me because I think we've talked about this before. So as soon as I saw that story was coming up about that book, Somebody is Walking on Your Grave, I thought, this is going to be my kind of book. So I have already gone on the website of the Lawrence Public Library and reserved that book. I'm number two in line. So whoever's number one, I hope you read it quickly when it comes in. Would that be you, Laura?
Is it you, I think Laura? It's possible. It's me.
What? Really? You reserved it?
I love this about Weekend Edition and NPR is that this is where I'm going to find, and apparently you are also going to find, weird kind of stories about books that are like, okay, it's a book about cemeteries and just this quirky, weird fascination. She called them peregrines, people that flock to cemeteries. But I find like this is my home. here on NPR.
Oh, yeah.
This is why I love Weekend Edition Sunday, and this is why I'm so glad we are coming to you today to ask for your support for Weekend Edition. You can pledge now at kansaspublicradio.org.
Or give us a call at 888-577-5268. Goth girlies represent in here today. I am not kidding. It might be me, though I thought I was third, so maybe not. I don't know.
I'm number
Whatever.
Two, so maybe
we'll
there's more than one copy.
We'll see each other at the library, so, well, which we probably
we'll
will.
We'll duke it out.
Because that's Lawrence. That's
Laura,
just how things work.
Laura, if you're third, you know who has the book.
Exactly.
If it's
I can
just
track
not being
down.
Released, and you feel like, hey, it should be available by now. You can just talk to your coworker.
I could.
She was number two.
888-577-5268 or online at kansaspublicradio.org. We still have one opportunity for you to take advantage of Deb Duncan's...
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. You can listen online at kansaspublicradio.org. And of course, while you're there, we'll be taking your pledges during our Fall Fanfare 2025.
Support for KPR's Community Spotlight comes from the Sunflower Foundation in Topeka, with a mission to serve as a catalyst for improving the health of all Kansans. More information is available at sunflowerfoundation.org.
Looks like a beautiful Sunday ahead. Sunny skies today, highs in the upper 80s, light winds from the south. Mostly clear overnight tonight, lows in the lower 60s. And for tomorrow, sunny highs in the lower 80s. It's 63 in Atchison, 65 in Emporia, 63 in Topeka. This is KPR.